Yeah, my name's Scott. I'm Scott Smythe. I live on the Wirral. I'm 54 years old. Normal guy, normal life. Worked all over, worked my whole life. Raced motorbikes, relative success, was second at the Manx Grand Prix. Worked away most of my life and then decided to get closer to home and got a job in Camel Airs and then a job in Airbus. Did okay out the property market. Was always into bikes and then did a track day and that was it. Went racing. So I had two houses, sold one of the houses and spent the money on racing and start my own business, which was fixing motorbikes. So the last sort of 12, up to 2018, I was 12 years in business. MOT inspector, normal life, got my own house, paid for. Mum lived not exactly opposite, but on the opposite side of the road, two doors down.
Can you just take us through what happened with your mum and solicitors, please?
Yeah. So like I say, we're living a normal life and we're not bothering anybody. In 2015, in February 2015, I'd come home at a different time and decided to just pop across the road and see me mum. So I've let myself in, and as I've opened the door, I could hear voices. So I've walked down the hallway, and I've entered the kitchen, and my mum's there with three women in the kitchen. And she's religious, my mum, so I thought, oh, she's got the Jehovah's Witnesses or whatever in, So I'm like, hi. And they're like, hi. I said, who are you? And they said, we're carers. And I went, carers? What do you mean, carers? At which point they all looked at each other very uncomfortably and asked me, had I spoken to social services? To which I replied, no. And I asked them for the number. They said they didn't have the number and they'd get social services to ring me. So, I'm a little bit confused. I'm asking my mum, why have you got carers in the house? And she said, oh, they're just friends. So appointment was made and I met social services. She was an agency social worker. I won't disclose any names. I'm not joking. The first question that she asked me was, does your mum own this house? Kind of got rung the alarm bells, but she said, your mum's got dementia. I'm like, okay, so when did she get diagnosed with dementia? And it was 12 months earlier. She was diagnosed with dementia. And when I asked why wasn't I told, she turned around and said that my mum had said that she didn't want me telling. Now, what I need to add is my mum and dad had split up. Mum lived opposite on her own, no brothers and sisters. And there really was just mum and I. When mum and dad were together, he worked away. So most of my life, from about 7 or 8, he worked away and it was just mum and I. So I found it very hard to believe that, my mum wouldn't want me telling. So I'm kind of confused and bewildered and quite ignorant, I suppose, because we're just getting on with life. So there was no power of attorney in place. Mum said you get in the house and that was it kind of thing. Well, within a couple of months, what happened is now I'm in the knowledge that mum's got dementia. I take the liberty of opening a mail. And obviously I'm calling over now 3-4 times a day. I opened a mail and it was a bank account statement and there was no money in the bank. For some reason, I think it was the gas or whatever, just kept taking the money out and putting it back in. So I've gone to the bank and put some money in to sort the bills out. And the next day, another envelope, which was another account, which was a post office account. And there was money in that account. So I decided to go down to spoke to my mum, explained to her. So I've gone down to the bank to the post office and said to the post office, is there any way you can transfer all the direct debits and whatnot from the bank into here and we'll just use you? And they couldn't do that because it was a paying in account only. So they advised me to go get power of attorney. They'd sort the thing out with the bank. So I've given the details and they've gone and sorted it out with the bank. I've got home and I've rang social services and I've told them what I've done. So we'll be expecting a bank account and, you know, mum's going to be a lot better off now. And then I had a meeting with a manager from the DWP and explained to the manager from the DWP what I'd done. She agreed that what I'd done was the right thing to do and advised me also to go and get power of attorney. So, as I say, I've rung the social services, told them what I've done, and I've asked them, would they help me, because I didn't know anything about it, to get power of attorney. And they said they couldn't because mum already lacked capacity. Now, apparently, when she'd told the GP or whoever it was who diagnosed her with dementia, that at the time she was diagnosed, this is what I was told, she had capacity. So it's a bit confusing when you can be diagnosed with dementia but still have capacity. So anyway, I'm refused the opportunity for a power of attorney. And a couple of days later, I've received a letter from the DWP to say that I was no longer mum's financial deputy. So basically what had happened is this social worker had made fraudulent claims against me of me committing fraudulent money activity. And she held a meeting in private with the police and the DWP and themselves, obviously the adult social services, with claims that I was committing fraudulent money activity. And basically they self-appointed themselves financial deputy for me mum without any court of protection application or any power of attorney. They just self-appointed themselves financial deputies.
Okay, Scott, look, just let me intervene a sec there, because yeah. It sounds to me like what's happened is the social services have taken over your mother's affairs.
Yeah.
And I don't quite understand what gives them the right to do that under your nose, because quite clearly you are much closer to your mum and you are much more likely to do what she wants than they are.
Absolutely. So yeah, this is what they did, and basically they took control of a pension and they froze a bank account. Now when she passed away, apparently the bank account was never frozen. Well, I'm saying she froze the bank account because when the card arrived, I've gone down to the bank to get my mum some money. I put the card in the machine, put the password in, and it just swallowed the card. So I went to the bank the next day, and this manager came out and said, the account's frozen, and you need to go to the court of protection. So I've gone home and I've told my mum, and she's like, I should be getting money here. Where's my pension? So I said, yeah, mum, let's ring the social services. Because now I'm starting to, you know, it's all starting to like click into place. So I rung her and I said, at the time I rung her, I've had no knowledge of this meeting. Do you know what I mean? I got the knowledge of the meeting from a subject access request. So, yeah, I've rung the social services and my mum's saying, so, well, you know, where's my money? She's going, you can't have it. Just made a load of it. I can't remember precise things she said, but my mum was upset. And I just said to the woman, I said, you're out of order what you've done. You know, I'm going to seek legal advice, but apparently what they did was legal. So, The next thing is I get an envelope in the door, my house, at my house, with 60 quid in it. With a note just saying, for provisions for your mum. So I've told my mum, and my mum's took that money. And then a few days later, there's another 60 quid. And by this time I'd woke up, I thought, hang on a minute. You stuck 60 quid through the door with a note saying provisions for your mum. Where did that 60 quid come from? Do you know what I mean? You know, and there needs to be a paper trail for that 60 quid. But at the moment, it's not very professional. So I kept hold of that 60 quid. I've still got it. Still got it in an envelope put away. So for 7 months nearly, we have no access to any of mum's money. So I've looked after it. I've fed it and I've clothed it. And I've made a conscious decision to keep all the receipts. And then come about December time, I got a letter through the door saying we're applying to the Court of Protection for your mum's property and affairs. So I've contacted them and I've arranged a meeting. Now, by this time, this agency social worker, because I'm putting them under pressure now, I'm recording everything. I'm recording everything, every meeting, every telephone call. This agency social worker vanishes, goes on the sick or something, disappears, and this new one. But I'm unaware of this until we have the meeting. So we have this meeting, and this one's like, hi, my name's... I'm like, where have you come from? Where's the other one? You know, why haven't you told me? You know, how long have you been appointed to me, mum? You know, all the normal questions that you should ask, and you didn't have an answer. But with the meeting in mind, I'd had a couple of weeks to, prove that mum wasn't... She was ill, and yes, she was starting to get really forgetful, but she wasn't totally incapacitated to the point where, after the phone call asking why they'd frozen the bank account, mum said, right, we need to make a will. And she got the neighbours in and we made a will. I think I spoke to you a little bit, didn't I, last time? So, so she, you know, although she's lacked capacity, she had the presence of mind to realise that something was going on and to make a will. I had the presence of mind to record my my routine. So I started to just voice record it, not video record it. So I'm at the door. I'm going to open the door. I'm coming in the house. So the first one, I'm at the door. I'm opening the door. So you hear me shout, mum, where are you, mum? Okay, I'm going up the stairs. So I've gone up the stairs. I've gone into the bedroom. I said, hiya, mum. She was in bed. I said, hiya, mum. You okay? She's woke up. Oh, son, I'm frightened. Why, mum? What's wrong? I keep forgetting everything. I don't know what's going on, blah, blah, blah. I said, oh, mum, listen, you've got dementia. Yeah, the doctor said that. So this was December 2015. So she was diagnosed in February 2014, but February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November. So that's nine. It's nearly 18 months. It's over 18 months later, isn't it? She's got the capacity to remember that she's been diagnosed with dementia. And then she turned around and said, I want you to look after me, son. I want you to look after me. So it was after that I moved mum in with me. They didn't like it. I got a key safe. I took all of their front room and I put it in my front room. And I took all of her bedroom and I put it in the front, you know, I exited the front bedroom and I put her bedroom in the front bedroom. So it was basically just like being in her own house. And then one day I got a phone call. Now you've got to bear in mind that the whole time during diagnosis to me finding out, which was just shy of 12 months, they hadn't been able to get contact with me mum. So she'd missed out on the most crucial time for care. And they couldn't gain access. And I've got proof of that because I have a social worker's note there. I did lots of subject access requests and I've got social worker's notes. And in September 2014, it says, if you still can't gain access, knock at the son's house. He lives in the same road. They never knocked. So, yeah, I've moved mum in with me.
Yeah, can you, Scott, explain what you meant when you said that they didn't like it when you moved your mum in with you? Obviously, this is quite clearly the sensible thing to do. Your mum needs care. You're nearby. You're able to give that care. She's asked you for that care, and yet they didn't like it.
No. They wanted the house, you see. Basically, and I don't want to start sounding like a conspiracy theorist, right, but from my experience, right, they're on a land grab and they're doing anything possible to take all assets from all vulnerable people. And there's a slogan that kind of backs up my gut feeling. And the new slogan is, you'll own nothing and be happy. So that's, well, you know, they're on the land.
There's another slogan, isn't there? And that is, this is potentially fraud. This is robbery. This is theft.
It's more than theft. It's more than theft. It's a conspiracy to defraud people, and it includes, and dare I say it, murder. It includes murder. The Liverpool care pathway. It's not a care pathway.
Before we go into that, can you just finish the story about your mum now in your place?
Yeah, so you know, I'm looking after mum, and she was here for about 3 months. And then I got a phone call saying that mum had threatened to stab one of the carers and they weren't going back in the house. So I'm like, you know, God, what's going on? I didn't believe it because she wouldn't threaten to stab anyone. So anyway, I rings me dad's missus. She works in healthcare and that, and she's told me, she said, look, they're gonna just take your mum off you, they're gonna section her. She goes, it's horrible, but you need to get in there first. So I sectioned me mum. I sectioned me mum. She went to Clatterbridge Hospital. They're in there for a month. They get assessed, don't they? And you know, they're in there for a month. So I'm researching things now, and you know, I'm researching what they're going to do now when they put her into care. You know, they're going to put her under dolls, which is a deprivation of liberty. And then you know, I'm just seeing it all unfold, and I'm helpless. I'm absolutely helpless. I don't know the law. I don't know the legislation. They've got barristers, lawyers. They've got all kinds. They've got money backing them up. They've, you know, it's a firm, isn't it? It's a firm that you're up against. So after the month, I've researched. I've said, okay, you know, we've had a meeting with this consultant psychiatrist. I mean, here's one for you. Consultant or something in Catholic. But prior to that, when the grief was going on over the money and the power of attorney, a consultant psychiatrist called to the house. And I expressed, said, look, you know, blah, blah, they've done this, they've done that, they won't even help me get power of attorney. She turned around and said, I'm the one who decides who gets power of attorney. I said, oh, are you really? Yeah. She said, I've spent the last 8 months gaining your mother's trust and getting to know your mum. I said, have you really? She went, yeah. I said, okay. What's her favourite colour? You should have seen her face. You should have seen her face. She stormed out. She walked out. So you spent 8 months getting to know someone. You didn't even know the favourite colour. Hey? Right. So, yes. meets with this doctor at Clatterbridge. I said to him, listen, right, do not under any circumstances prescribe her risperidone, because I know that's what you give people with dementia. I said, it kills old people. I've researched it. You can research it yourself, and anyone listening to the show can research it yourself. It kills old people. It's for young people with bipolar and like schizophrenia. He just ignored me. He said, we're going to prescribe it. But it'll be a tiny, tiny amount, he said. It's a tiny, tiny amount. So I was then given the opportunity to find a home for her. And I found a place down the road. And it looked clean enough and it was modern enough. And I had a meeting with them and everything was sound. And I thought, you know, it's you know, I've got no choice. So this is probably the best, you know, I can get to see her as often as I can, because I could walk it in 5 minutes. So a date was arranged. And one thing I was told by this doctor was that my mum had qualified for section 117 aftercare. And what that is, basically, it's partly funded by the NHS and partly funded by the local authority, the care. They don't tell you about it. You've got to research it. I knew about it, but they told me about it and told me she'd qualified for it, so I didn't have to bring it up. I did tell them, though, that I was aware of it, and I thanked them. The date was set, and I had another meeting just prior, the day before mum was to go into this home. We had another meeting, and again, you know, we explained, and everything was rosy. And I'm sitting there, and I've had such a rough time with the social services and whatnot. You know, it was like a breath of fresh air, and I thought, oh, this is great, this. And then right at the very end, he said, we don't tolerate abusive behaviour. So I've looked at him and said, well, why would you say that? Well, only social services had gone in, hadn't they, and slagged me right off and told all kinds of lies about me, saying I was aggressive and this and that and the other. I'd never been aggressive to them. But what I did do, which they really, really despised, was record everything. And anyone who's listening and anyone who's going through this, record absolutely everything. Have a witness with you if you can, because you can't trust these people. So she's in the care home. I'm seeing her pretty much every day, and I'm taking her out at the weekends. And we had a great old time. And then things just started to change, and I was recording as... And this one come up and went, you can't be recording here. I said, I'm not recording anyone. I'm just recording mum and I can play it back to you. There's no one else. It's literally just mum and I in the shot. Yeah, well, you're not allowed to record. I'm like, okay, fair enough. So I kept that QT. And then I get this letter from the Court of Protection. And they are... applying for mum's health and welfare. And then the next thing I know is I've got this paperwork, and they're not even like statements. They're like little mad handwritten notes. I find Scott so intimidating because he's so much taller than me. I'm not joking. Right, I'm not joking. I've still got them. And then this other one, the manager one, she's put, I'm fearful that Scott's going to be waiting for me outside of work one day. So I've wrote to the judge and I've said to the judge, if someone feels like that, then there must have been some water flowing under the bridge, because you can't just feel like that. You know, something would have had to have gone on for someone to feel in fear of the safety like that. So it's gone to court, and I've been looking into common law and all kinds of things, and you know, I'm asking the judge, is he on his oath? I was probably really irritating, but I was integrity, and I maintained and kept the right to see me mum. It got to the stage where the judge said, can't you just all go outside and have a meeting, you know, and sort it out. So that fell flat on its face, and I continued maintain the right to see me mum. The next thing is they're applying now another letter from the Court of Protection. I forgot loads, you know, but I've got the main points. They're applying to another Court of Protection hearing now for mum's property and affairs. Now, for me, it's a conflict of interest, because her care was being funded, and I believe that the judge shouldn't have even entertained it. Anyway, the day of the hearing, now bearing in mind I've got my own business, I don't owe any taxes, I'm not breaking any, I haven't broken any laws, I'm not on the wanted list, anything like that, you know, anything like that. So I'm sitting in the house, and at 12 minutes past nine, the hearing's not till half 10. 12 minutes past nine, the police are doing criminal PNC searches on me. And coming through the tunnel it was about 10 past 10. As I'm exiting the Liverpool tunnel to go to the family court in Liverpool, there's a tunnel bobby stood in the middle of the road, hand up, pulls me over. He says, you flagged the AMPR for no insurance. I said, oh, mate, yeah, maybe. I said, hey, look, here's my insurance, because I had my own business. I carried my insurance, a responsible guy, passed him my insurance, showed him a license. Go and park in the car park. He said, I'll just go and check on your insurance. So after 15 minutes, you know, I'm late for court almost. I said to the lads, I said, I'm going to go and see what's going on here. So he goes into the little booth office, whatever, and he's just stood talking to his mates, leaning on the counter. He spun round, and I could see in his face, but it was only in hindsight, but he was like, oh, you know. I said, listen, mate. I said, you got me insurance. I told you where I'm going. You know where I'm going to be. If there's any problems, you can come and get me. So I got back in the car, left him with my insurance policy, and I went to the courts. I've walked into the reception area of the court and approached the desk. The guy behind the counter just hands me three gagging orders. So I looked at my mate and I went, wow, how did he not? And the guy behind, he says, what was that, mate? I said, oh, no, it's all right, nothing. So we went and sat down. I said to the lads, how did he know that was me? And how did he know it was, you know, how did he know to give us three gagging orders? Then the next thing, the judge comes out and looks at me as if to say, wow, what are you doing here? So he calls us to court. And guess what? The counsel never turned up. So I said to the judge, you need to throw this out. He said, oh, I can't do that. I said, no, you need to throw it out. So they've brought the hearing and they've not turned up. I said, and from last time, fiasco. I said, and you need to, we wouldn't throw it out. And then unfortunately, before the next hearing, mum succumbed to the risperidone and the Liverpool care pathway. He told me, we're putting your mum on end-of-life care. I'm like, why? She still recognised me. But she thinks she's your dad. Doesn't matter, does it? She still recognised me. She had someone to look, you know what I mean? So, yeah. I'm flabbergasted that the people that, you know, you're told in school and you believe, and whether you like the police or not, they're a necessary evil. And you believe that social services, they're here to help you, and they're not. Far from it.
Well, certainly not in your case. Can you just tell us what happened to your mum's property? Because there's a potential motive there for people to get their hands on that. Well, we've heard again and again that you know, you can get undervaluations for things. They can go onto auction sites where only the friends of the people putting them on the auction sites can bid, that sort of thing. So what happened? I mean, I would imagine it was the house that was most valuable.
It was the house that was most valuable, yeah. And it's unfortunate she died, but fortunate that she died because there was no hearing, was there? So it went straight to probate. And that was successful. So I got the house. But it's not about the house, is it? For me, it wasn't about the house for me.
I mean, it's a pretty horrific experience, Scott. Thanks for taking us through it. But have you got any lessons that you've learned from it all that you would like to share with listeners?
I mean, the first thing you need to and it's difficult. It's difficult for families to discuss money, isn't it? But, you know, the families need to set the differences aside and to discuss these things because, you know, not only was it my mum's property, right, but traditionally it was my inheritance. And you know, my mum was born in 1930. My dad was born in 1925. It was that generation that helped build this country after the war. It was that generation that worked to give the siblings a start in life, which was usually, if it wasn't a house to be sold to give them a start in life, it was a house for them to continue to live in and to keep in the family. So people need to discuss what's going to happen. Power of attorney is very, very important. And I think the most important thing, and what I've done with my property, is I've put it into trust. So it's not mine anymore. It belongs to the trust. And I think that's the only way you can guarantee that any assets are going to be passed on through generations. Don't let them go to social services, your family. Try and look after your family members if you can. I know it's difficult, but try. And if you have to deal with social services, record absolutely everything from the first meeting, record it. I don't know whether it's wise to tell them you're recording. I know legally that if it's just a one-on-one, you don't have to inform them. But do your research, you know. People need to do the research.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to the law about recordings, I mean, we had at the BBC, we were given a bit of a course on this, and if you can show that that you believe that there is reasonable cause, I don't know how you say that, you know, and how you would justify it. But if you believe that there's a reasonable cause, there is some sort of criminal intent of some kind or potential fraud, that you're quite within your rights to. I mean, we used to have this as reporters, you know, you had to go through a whole procedure if you were going to do hidden filming and this kind of thing. But once you could prove that there was some kind of potential criminal intent, then you could get permission to do it. And so I think, you know, we are in a situation now where the police all carry these recorders. And sometimes, as happened in Bristol recently, when the police do something very embarrassing, like raid somebody's house who happens to be one of the editors of the student newspaper at the university, who had nothing whatsoever to do with the crime that they were supposedly. And they just lose all the recorded evidence. So I think actually you're right. Recording things is very important. Of course, it's absolute prima facie evidence sometimes in court cases, which will sway a jury or a magistrate or judge if it's used in court. So this is evidence of, you know, people's, I mean, for example, with making a recorded will, for example. But one question I do have for you, though, is about will executors and who you think makes the most appropriate executors. Because you could end up, couldn't you, having a couple of will executors who are hammer and tongs, completely, you know, almost
against each other. Yeah. I mean, again, it's a difficult question, isn't it? Because, you know, you'd like to think a family member, wouldn't you? But sometimes that doesn't work out. Sometimes a total stranger would probably do a better job. I mean, it's a really, really difficult one. Lifelong friend, you know, someone that you know that has got morals and isn't going to, you know. I mean, it's a difficult one, isn't it? I think the trust probably the best thing, because
people can be quite good at getting themselves under the skin, particularly of people who are elderly. And also when it comes to your own situation with your mum, when it comes to the potential of sort of taking over affairs with powers of attorney, is there any way you can really make sure that doesn't happen? That some, you know, maybe someone from social services or, you know, another, a court official or whatever, takes over the property of your loved one?
Right. One thing that alarmed me I think it was the first hearing, the health and welfare, is they drafted in an official solicitor. Luckily, I think he was on my side. But historically, if an official solicitor gets involved, it's usually the state that will take over all them decisions. Do you know what I mean? You see, unfortunately for us, the legal system is geared that way, that what they do is actually legal.
Is there any way, for example, I mean, one of the obvious things that people might want to do is turn to a solicitor to help them. Is that wise? And if so, how should you do that?
Solicitors, God. It's a difficult question for me now, because I don't trust any of them. What I'd say is if you're gonna, anyone who's listening to this, and before it even happens, just study the relevant sections of law for probate, for executors and whatnot, and study it for yourself to try not to involve anyone. Luckily, I had a decent neighbour, so my probate went through really, really quickly. We went over to the probate office, sat there, answered the relevant questions, and it all went through. But there is other people where it's not that, as you know, Mark, it's not that straightforward.
Well, we're talking about Dr. Mark Jones. He's very strongly recommends that what you do is you get your family together, the people who are named in the will, together with the person who's making the will, and you actually do a video recording of it, or at the very least a sound recording, but a video recording is better. Although sometimes people don't like to do these things, then there's no questioning. I mean, it's peculiar, because in between
speaking... It's a necessary evil, that man, I think. That's a necessary evil.
To Mark Jones and yourself, I met a friend of mine who had been... he had been offered £30,000 to say that it wasn't his signature on a will. And it takes, you know, quite a lot of, integrity to say, no, I'm not having that £30,000 because as a signatory on that will, I mean, they were basically trying to rob the, you know, it was a considerable amount of possessions of the deceased. So, you know, there are people out there, predators out there, and it seems to me, you know, as hearing from you, you sound to me as if you're quite lucky in a way with some of what happened to you. But there are predators out there who see the law as so weak that they can use it to literally steal people's goods from vulnerable people.
I can tell you, you know, when I got stopped, when I got stopped coming out the tunnel, basically what happened, they were doing criminal PNC searches on me because I'd been stopped in the car several times and nothing had ever come to light. So basically what's happened is someone's gone digging, and I think that might have been the judge. And this thing, basically what had happened is 12 years prior, I was disqualified from driving for 12 months. Now, apparently it was for dangerous driving and I should have resat an extended driving test. So for dangerous driving, resit an extended driving test is a mandatory order. But this mandatory order didn't make its way to the DVLA. The disqualification did. I was unaware of a mandatory order. The DVLA were unaware of a mandatory order. I've served my disqualification, applied for my licence, and been given a full licence. I've been driving for 12 years on a full licence. But apparently not. So what the courts did, they pulled me over for it first, told me it was AMPR. I asked for the AMPR. That never materialised. Came to my shop the next day, all mob-handed. Threatening me with arrest and all that, needed to go for a voluntary interview. And as it transpired, this order had come to light. The courts then colluded, I can only say colluded, or corresponded with the DVLA. And without a hearing, without an explanation, without an apology, removed my license entitlement. Then, Mersey Travel, the tunnel police, took me to court for driving whilst disqualified. And I was prosecuted for driving whilst disqualified and no insurance. Even though I did not have a clue. And at the time, I had a qualified driver with me. I told the judge I had a qualified driver with me. So really, all you can do me for is no L plates. Just ignored me. Fined me, give me points, and told me that I needed to resit an extended driving test. That really hurts because I had to shut my business. My head was kettled anyway. Yeah, it was absolutely kettled. And I just shut the shop. And now I'm unemployed. I've been unemployed for 7 years. I've been sitting, researching. And I'm now at the stage where I can't be... and God love them, but I can't be like the people from Gosport. I can't be 30 years down the line still. You know, the doors are shut. They've closed ranks. There's nothing I can do about it. So now I'm looking to find a better life and future in a different country.
Well, I mean, the thing is, if you you give in to this, then surely this is almost like a pat on the back to the crooked officials.
It is, but when you're getting nowhere and you're not really going to get anywhere, how much of your life can you consume?
Well, why did you have to close your business?
Because I had no license. I had a motorbike shop. Sorry, I had a motorbike shop.
Yeah, but you can run a motorbike business without a license, surely.
No, because you need to test ride bikes when you repair them.
Didn't you have any employees?
No.
Well, maybe employ someone to do that.
I could have done. But, my head was cattled.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is what I'm getting at here, Scott, is that they've got to you psychologically, haven't they?
Yeah, listen, Christ. I've got the door ringing me now saying, oh, we need to get you into work. And I'm saying, don't put me with people, please. Please leave me alone. I'm not to be around people. I need out. I need out. I need out this country, Tone. I need out, mate. I've had enough.
Well, I mean, it sounds to me like, you know, you've been the victim of some kind of gang stalking or whatever. Yeah. And it's, you know, you have maybe, you know, some of the reason for this is because you've actually fought for your mum successfully in many ways. And they don't like that when someone is actually doing it for the love rather than, you know, actually what they, it seems to me, have been committing is at the very least the perversion of the course of justice, probably much more like malfeasance, misfeasance,
all of it,
you know, malfeasance. Actually, this is misconduct in public office.
Yeah.
Is it, you know, that you can get a life sentence for that.
You know, is it in the public's best interest to take a license off a man after 12 years on a court error?
Well,
I mean, all the paperwork, Tony, was destroyed. All the files were destroyed.
It's not in the public interest, quite clearly. It's in their own interests, and they are misusing public office. So, but of course, who's going to prosecute that? Merseyside Police, maybe. Anyway, look, Scott, whereabouts can people find you if you're, even if you flee the country? Is there somewhere online people can connect if they want to have a chat, get advice about how to deal with similar situations?
Yeah, I mean, you can get me on Mr. Bullet, Mr. B-U-L-L-E-T, 131, the numbers.
Is that M-R?
Mr. M-R Bullet. Basically, Mr. Bullet's come from, we used to go out riding on the road before I went racing, and I used to have to pull over and wait for people, and I got called the Bullet, the Birkenhead Bullet. So, Mr. Bullet, 131 at outlook.com. I also started a Facebook group called Dementia Fraud Awareness. I just thought, you know, I'll start this thing off. I came off it and I've come back on as a moderator under Missy Pretty. I'm staying off the social media and that, but I call in and look at it every now and again. Dementia Fraud Awareness on Facebook. And I thought, you know, this can't be just me, so I'm going to get it out there. And that's why I started the group. And while I was in control of it, it started to pick up, but it's kind of gone a bit stagnant. But the 400 and odd members that are on there, you know, it's posts regularly. So, yeah, you know, it's still ticking over. Also, yeah. I started a forum, and that's www.dementiafraud.forummotion.com. And on there, I got a lot of the people from Facebook to put their half-page cases, they're called, and there's quite a few of them. Mark's is on there. Dementiafraud.forummotion.com. And finally, and some of the videos I'm probably not proud of now, but, you know, you've got to understand that my head was kettled. And I was looking into common law. I was listening to someone and getting the wrong advice. So it's a YouTube channel. It's called Public Sector Jobsworths. It used to be called Public Sector Criminals. But I think Jobsworths is probably more fitting.
Okay, Scott Smythe, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Tom. Cheers, mate.